morning. The meeting of House Fisheries Committee will come to order at 10:08 a.m. in room 120 on March 24th. Welcome, everyone. Please turn your cell phones off so there's no ringing while we're presenting. Members present are Representative Ortiz, Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Heron, Representative Foster, and myself, Chair Stutes. We're also joined by Kelly Burnett from House Records, Sam Greeley from the LIO, and of course, my trusty fisheries aide, Reed Harris. Today we're going to have a number of presenters, experts in their own fields, whose presentations will make up our State of the Salmon. Presenters are going to be Lindsay Bloom from Independent Salmon Consultants, Heather Hardcastle, Salmon Beyond Borders, Julianne Curry from United Fishermen of Alaska, Stephanie Madsen at Sea Processors, Julie Bonney from the Ground Fish Data Bank, Ryan Manister? McKinster. I like to get people's names correct. From Southeast Alaska Guides Organization and Ricky Geese, Kenai River Sporting Association. Each presenter will have about 10 minutes, and then we will have questions at the end of the presentations and public testimony at the end of the presentations. So we'll start with Lindsay Bloom, Independent Salmon Consultants. Please state your name for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Stutes. Lindsay Bloom, for the record. I'm a fisheries consultant. I reside here in Juneau. I was born and raised here in Juneau. And I was feeling a little nervous about coming this morning, but my history is over a decade of commercial fishing in Bristol Bay and skippering a drift net boat. And so while you guys are important, you're not nearly as intimidating as the Northline Big Gig any given day. So. And I just wanted to offer some remarks to get started and to maybe frame the topic of wild salmon in Alaska for you and get some thoughts going on that front. I'm certainly not going to take 10 minutes, and I'll do my best to be brief. I don't think any of us need reminding that when we look at the history of wild salmon throughout the world and in the rest of the country, we are now truly about the last wild salmon state, and we are in Alaska the salmon state. And I think as Alaskans we have tremendous pride in that, not only is salmon a food source and a major driver of our economy, as you'll hear from other speakers, but it's really a defining characteristic for Alaskans. It's something that overwhelming numbers of Alaskans connect to in very deep ways, as everyone knows. I think politically salmon is really important. And, you know, provides a lot of opportunity. Maybe one of the few places for Alaskans where you're basically going to find common ground. There is not an Alaskan that's going to tell you that they don't value salmon in one way or another. And in that sense, its capacity to unify Alaskans, I think, is really important. I hope when you listen to the presentations today that you'll think about not just, you know, the information and the discussion, but I think it's a really important time in your positions in this building to think about policymaking and setting us up for a bright future in fisheries management and salmon stewardship. We've done very well so far as a state because of some really smart choices, decisions, and policies that originated in the Constitution. And that said, there's huge challenges ahead, as we all know, and it's going to take, you know, forward-thinking, proactive action and leadership from this committee and your colleagues in this building to get us where we all want to be for our children and grandchildren decades from now. So I don't think I need to say a whole lot more than that. I just really want to thank you for taking an entire day, given everything that you legislators have on your plate this session, to, again, take the lead, to be proactive, to have this discussion about salmon, and thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming and your testimony. The next presenter will be Heather Hardcastle, Salmon Beyond Borders. Hi, Heather. Please state your name for the record.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Heather Hardcastle, and I'm co-owner of Taku River Reds, as well as the main coordinator of Salmon Beyond Borders. And as Lindsay said, I thank you for hosting the Salmon Symposium. Thank you, Reed, for putting it all together. And it's an honor to be invited to speak on the issue of salmon and large-scale mining in transboundary watersheds. So I was born and raised here in Juneau. I spent the majority of every summer of my life thus far within a couple-mile radius of the Taku River, grew up commercial fishing with my family, and now co-own Taku River Reds, whereby we market pressure-bred high-end salmon across the country, including most years to the legislative lounge. We just ran out of inventory this year. And when I think about myself and my identity as a person, I think about my pride in being a Southeast Alaskan, my pride in being a fisherman's daughter, and my pride in being a mother. And I certainly didn't expect to be in the position I am now at this stage of my life as coordinator of an international campaign to safeguard transboundary salmon rivers. But here I am, and I'm honored to be in this role. I work with a diversity of people across the border, and they keep me going, honestly. There are folks from across all sectors and from across the political spectrum that are concerned about the health of rivers that flow into Southeast Alaska from British Columbia. And in its simplest terms, how we describe this problem is that large-scale mining in British Columbia currently threatens Alaska water quality and salmon. And close corollaries to that main problem statement are that we do not, as the state of Alaska and as the U.S., have an equal seat at any table with British Columbia and Canada to discuss how and if our shared watersheds are developed. And then second to that, we certainly don't have enforceable protections in place for salmon and for water quality in this part of the world. Now, I hope you can kind of see most of what this map represents. This is what we refer to as the transboundary region. There are several watersheds that straddle the northwest British Columbia, southeast Alaska border, and those are in green. And from north to south, the rivers of this really rugged, wild region include the Taku, the Whiting, the Stikine, and the Yunik. Now, the Nass River watershed is also included on this map at the bottom. It's not technically a transboundary watershed because that river doesn't drain into southeast Alaska, but it's awfully close. Collectively, these watersheds are about 30,000 square miles, or about the size of the state of Maine, and they are the lifeblood of this region. They have been the centers of commerce and culture for Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people for thousands of years, and certainly for those of us who live here, they're the centers of our way of life, and their economic powerhouses. You might be aware that for the last 4 years running, Southeast Alaska has been home to the largest salmon harvest by poundage and also the most lucrative salmon harvest. And these transboundary rivers are key drivers of that productivity. You can also see that a very small portion of these watersheds are on the U.S. side. The majority of these watersheds and the spawning and rearing grounds for salmon are predominantly on the Canadian side. We've done a very good job on this side of protecting salmon habitat in these watersheds. On the U.S. side of these watersheds, they're fully encompassed either by wilderness, national monument, or national forest non-development status. Now, it's a wholly different story on the other side. And all those dots you see there, the colored dots, refer to mining projects in British Columbia that are targeting, for the most part, gold and copper ore bodies. And these ore bodies are sulfide-bearing. They're also, for the most part, low-grade ore. So open pits and underground mining techniques are needed to get at diffuse minerals. The chance for acid mine drainage is also quite high because sulfide minerals are prevalent in these ore bodies. And then finally, these mining projects, for the most part, include tailing storage facilities and water treatment facilities that need to operate in perpetuity. And the colored dots indicate what stage of development these projects are in. And I want to highlight three projects in particular. Up at the top of the map is the Tulsa Quachief mine in the Taku watershed. Those of us here in Southeast are very familiar with that mine. Since 1957, when it was abandoned, it's been leaching acid mine drainage into the Tulsaqua River, a tributary of the Taku, without cleanup. If you go down now to the KSM mine near the bottom of the map in the Unic watershed, that is a project that, if developed as proposed, would be one of the largest or the largest gold and copper mine in North America. And last year, Representative Christ Tompkins, Alaska's congressional delegation, the state of Alaska, thousands of Alaskans, thousands of Canadians requested that the Canadian federal government give KSM the strictest environmental review. And it was denied, that those requests were denied just before Christmas of last year. And it's in full swing in the permitting process. And then finally, if you can look at that blue dot, Red Chris mine in the Stikine watershed, that mine just opened on February 3rd. And it's currently filling its tailings facility and trucking copper concentrate to Stewart for shipment to markets. The Red Chris mine is owned by Imperial Metals, which also owns Mount Polly mine, that you may recognize as being infamous for the sense that the tailings storage facility at Mount Polly suffered a catastrophic breach last August. So exactly 6 months later, its sister mine, Red Chris, was opened. And this picture here is of Mount Polly mine, of course. And I include it here in just a quick discussion about threats of all of these mining projects. I think in very simple terms, again, those of us engaged on this issue are gravely concerned about irreparable damage to water quality and salmon habitat from these projects. And it's not necessarily going to mean a catastrophic failure of a tailings facility like this one. Although BC experts state that when you use watered tailings facility technology like that is used here and is used at Red Chris, chances of tailings spills are very high, upwards of 2 per every 10 years. But we're concerned about the cumulative impacts of all of these projects over a broad landscape and what that truly means for the health of these transboundary rivers. We're also concerned about just chronic issues when you have so many projects that are so large. You talk about acid mine drainage, for example, stemming from just the walls of open pits and waste rock piles. We're in a very wet part of the world, obviously, and it's seismically active, so it's hard to see how clear damage to downstream interests is not inevitable. I also just want to reiterate again that we currently do not have a seat at the table. Alaska and the U.S. does not have any kind of a seat at a forum to discuss how these watersheds are managed. And that brings us then to what I and many others see as the solution. And it's not going to be easy, obviously. Nothing ever needed is truly easy. And I think about it in two parts. The first part is we first need this forum for equal engagement. We need an ability for the state of Alaska and for the U.S. State Department to come to an equal table with Canada and British Columbia. And after many years of research, we've discovered that, amazingly, there's really no policy mechanism out there except for what is known as the International Joint Commission. And this is a body that was created by the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909, and it would allow equal numbers of experts from both countries to study the potential cumulative effects of multiple mining projects on these watersheds. But even the IJC, and I should state before I move on to the second part of the solution, that currently Alaska's congressional delegation, Senators Murkowski, Sullivan, Congressman Young, are in support of an IJC process, as are 11 municipalities and counting in Southeast Alaska, 14 tribes in Southeast Alaska, AFN, Alaska Native Brotherhood, Alaska Native Sisterhood, the list goes on. But that second part of the solution is what I see as the end goal, and that is enforceable protections for salmon and water quality in this region. And this really gets at the heart of what Lindsay opened with. This is the opportunity that's before us. We feel threatened right now with upstream mining activity, but the opportunity is to create something wholly new in an international area that truly safeguards our resources that are of global significance. And I'll just close by saying, I just mentioned this to Bruce Wallace in the audience, but a year ago today, commercial fishing leaders, myself, and tribal leaders went back to Washington, D.C. to talk with folks at the State Department, to talk to our congressional delegation, to talk to other federal agencies, and ask for their help in bringing this to the attention of our neighbors in Canada. And the advice of the State Department folks was to go home and organize, tell our story, and raise a stink. So we are doing our best to do just that. And Salmon Beyond Borders has coalesced as a pretty robust campaign in the last year. And I include the logo here in the lower right of the United Tribal Transboundary Mining Work Group, another group that has coalesced and is becoming a formal nonprofit organization this week. And I had hoped a tribal representative could join me today, and it just didn't work with scheduling conflicts. But we are doing our best to organize and work across the border, and we thank you for your interest in this issue. We thank you for tracking it. And as you can, please seriously consider helping to take action, and some of you already have, and we appreciate that. Representative Christ Tompkins and Representative Ortiz, who recently introduced a resolution asking for the International Joint Commission to become involved in the issue. And thank you. I'm happy to take any questions if there's time.
Thank you. We'll have time, hopefully, at the end of all the presentations. So we certainly do appreciate your time in coming and giving us this information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next presenter is Julianne Curry from United Fishermen of Alaska. Good morning. Certainly. We'll take just a brief at ease while she sets up.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julianne Curry. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska. We are the statewide seafood industry association representing 36 member organizations and over 450 individuals and businesses who participate in fisheries throughout the state of Alaska and the offshore federal waters. The economics that you see here are real dollar values and do not include the multiplier effects that are typically included in economic reports. There's very little data for the seafood industry that includes multiplier effects. In Alaska, we have five species of salmon. King, the most iconic, is also known as Chinook. Sockeye, the most plentiful in the Bristol Bay fisheries, is also known as Red. Cohos are also known as Silvers. Pinks, by far the largest commercial harvest every year, are also known as humpies. And last but not least, Kita, an underrated species that is bolstered by successful hatchery operations and is affectionately known as Chum. There are four ADF&G management areas in Alaska. You are currently sitting in the southeast region, which spans from Ketchikan to Yakutat. The central region includes Prince William Sound, Cook Inlet, and over to Bristol Bay. The westward region includes Kodiak and the Aleutians, and the Arctic and Yukon-Kuskokwim management area takes up the rest of the state. There are various methods and vessels used to harvest salmon in the state of Alaska. The first you see here is a seine vessel, where salmon are encircled by a net. The net is hauled on board by a power block, and the fish are brought on board all at once at the end of a purse. The maximum length of these vessels is 58 feet. The next vessel you see here is a gill netter, featuring Jerry McCune, also president of United Fishermen of Alaska, where salmon are picked out of a net one by one, and the net is hauled on board with a drum. Gill netters are typically 30 to 40 feet in length. In Alaska, we also have set nets, which are set by a skiff and anchored to the shore. The net is hauled by hand.
Excuse me, just one moment. Is it a clarification? Reverend, here we go again. We went through this last week. I'm sorry, Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. Just a clarifying question. I was wondering if you could identify the seiner in the previous slide.
The seiner, this one here? This picture was actually taken right outside of Juneau. This is a fishery that is perpetuated by the Dipak hatchery of Chums, and that's actually my father's vessel, the F.E. Gene C., which is on its way back from Sitka from participating in the herring fishery. And if you look really, really close, you can actually see me on that boat.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Christ Tompkins. So in Alaska, we also have set nets, which are set by skiff and anchored to the shore. The net is hauled by hand, and fish are plucked out after it cork bobs. These are typically multi-generational family operations. And troll vessels catch salmon individually on 4 to 6 lines with hooks deployed from long poles. This is a low-volume, high-value fishery. Troll vessels range in size from small hand troll skiffs to ocean-going vessels that can be 50 feet or greater. Trolling is only allowed in Southeast Alaska. Salmon is the most valuable commercial fishery managed by the state of Alaska, with an average ex-vessel value of $544 million. Commercial fisheries for salmon extend from Ketchikan to Kotzebue, as well as deep into the interior of Alaska along the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. More Alaskans are employed in harvesting and processing salmon than any other commercial fishery. Here you can see the total Alaska salmon harvest and value in 2014. Keep in mind that ex-vessel value is only the price paid to the permit holder at the dock. So in 2014, there were 5.78 million pounds of Chinook landed, 245 million pounds of sockeye, 43.4 million pounds of coho, 329 million pounds of pinks, and 93.6 million pounds of chums, for an overall estimated ex-vessel value of $576.6 million. In Alaska, salmon are iconic. Nearly every Alaskan is in some way impacted by salmon. Alaska residents harvest salmon either through personal use, sport, commercial, or subsistence methods. Every Alaskan is also able to access salmon in grocery stores and restaurants throughout the state. And in addition to a love for salmon, Alaskans are also proud of our deep history as a commercial harvesting state. Commercial salmon harvest has been recorded in Alaska since 1878 and is a thriving industry today. The guiding issue behind Alaska achieving statehood was commercial salmon harvest. With statehood, Alaska took control of management of salmon, therefore protecting Alaskans' dependence on our most prized resource. Since statehood, Alaska has worked hard to develop our reputation as having the best managed fisheries in the world. According to the McDowell Group, approximately 20,000 people participated in commercial salmon fisheries as a permit holder or as a crew member in 2013. All in all, 38,000 people are employed by the commercial salmon harvesting sector in Alaska. Commercial salmon harvesters live in over 160 communities throughout the entire state of Alaska. Salmon harvest is vital to the health of Alaska and to employment in this state. Virtually every business in Alaska benefits from commercial salmon fishing dollars. Through support of dozens of support businesses, such as hardware and marine suppliers, fuel, air, and water travel, shipping, restaurants, supermarkets, boat builders, shipyards, accountants, scientists, educators, and administrators. In the same way that the oil industry produces significant spin-off effects on a statewide level, the salmon industry provides similar benefits to fishing communities. Utilities, shipping costs, fuel costs, airfare, and tax rates are lower in these communities as a result of salmon industry activity. The salmon industry provides economies of scale that drive down the cost of these items for year-round residents. In closing, Madam Chair, UFA has also produced a set of commercial fishing fact sheets that details the importance of the seafood industry in the state of Alaska, including a breakdown of the taxes and fees paid by the industry. They are available on our website, and they will be hand-delivered to each of your offices. Thank you for the opportunity to present.
Thank you. Nice presentation. We appreciate your time and coming, and we will have questions, as I mentioned earlier, after the balance of the presenters have had a chance to present. Thank you. Let's see. Our next presenter is Stephanie Madsen, who represents the At-Sea Processors Association. Do you need to set up?
Yeah, just real quick. I think he's going to...
Okay, we'll take that.
Chair, members of the Fisheries Committee, my name is Stephanie Madsen. I'm Executive Director of the At-Sea Processors Association. Your presentations are going to take a little bit of a twist here because I'm here to tell you how I avoid catching Chinook salmon. On a personal note, I enjoy sport fishing for salmon, but in my line of work and the fisheries that I represent, they are a prohibited species and we try very hard to avoid them. This morning, I'm just going to briefly run through who we are, a brief overview of Amendment 91, which is the federal fisheries program for the pollock fishery in the Bering Sea with the Chinook caps. I'm going to talk a little bit about how the CP fleet is reducing its Chinook bycatch and a little bit about what's new in our IPA. IPA stands for Incentive Plan Agreement. I was here, Madam Chair, back in 2013 in front of the Fisheries Committee, giving you a little bit more detail about the program because it had just been implemented. But today I'm going to just kind of talk a little bit about the years that have gone by and what we've been doing. To talk a little bit about who we are, you might hear Pollock Conservation Cooperative and At-Sea Processors. We're one and the same. The At-Sea Processors is the trade association. The Pollock Conservation Cooperative is the structure of our fishery. And we are allowed to form cooperatives, and that's where the pollock allocation is managed, and that's where we house the salmon program. I know, Madam Chairman and members of the committee, that oftentimes when you think about federal fisheries, and that's what I'm talking about today is a federal fishery, that you might think that federal fisheries means non-Alaskans or people from the lower 48, and that state fisheries mean Alaskan. Well, that's not a good summary. As you can see here, the vessel in the top right is owned and operated by Coastal Villages Regional Fund. It's the Northern Hawk, and it is a community development quota organization out of Bethel. The vessel on your left is the Northern Glacier, and it is partially owned by NSCDC, Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation. And then in the lower panel, you have American Seafoods vessel, which is also partly owned by Central Bering Sea Community Development Quota. So as you can see, we have a lot of Alaskan ownership in our fleet. This is just real quickly, Madam Chair, some of our products. Alaska pollock fishery is the largest fishery in the United States. It's one of the largest in the world. It's roughly valued about $500 million. As you can see, we're trying to expand our markets into the school lunch program. We're trying to move away a little bit from the traditional markets in Japan, which is the picture of the Kamaboko. We do pay landing tax on every pound of pollock that's landed, no matter where we land it in the United States. We do pay the state of Alaska a landing revenue. Each vessel has about 100, 150 crew on board, so we do employ quite a few people. Madam Chair, this, as we learned back in 2013 when I was here, the council provided a pretty innovative approach to our fleet in avoiding Chinook bycatch. We have a PSC limit, prohibited species catch limit, that says that if we catch a certain amount, then we are shut down. But in order to incentivize our behavior, we talk about incentive plan agreements. Incentive plan agreements are submitted to the National Fisheries Service for approval. And, Madam Chair, the next two slides that you probably want to spend a little bit of time looking at your leisure are the components of our required provisions of an IPA. We do have to provide annual reports to the Council and the National Fisheries Service every April 1st, and so we're coming up on our next annual report. Just a reminder that there's quite a few sectors in the pollock fishery. I represent the CP sector, but there is a CDQ portion, a mothership portion that catcher vessels delivering to motherships, and catcher vessels that deliver to shoreside processors. There's two limits that we have. You often hear about the 60,000 limit. That's an upper cap, and that shuts us down. The performance standard limit that is highlighted in red is really the limit that we live within. If we exceed that limit in 2 out of 7 years, then that becomes our limit. So we have a real incentive and are required to produce demonstrations that would show that our program for our fleet would stay under that limit. So really the number you want to look at is the performance standard limit number. In our CP IPA, we have the CP fleet, as you can imagine, needs to stay on fish. And so when we were developing our program, we realized the most valuable incentive is for a fleet or a vessel my size, our size, to stay on the fleet, on the fish. We need consistent product, going through the factory. We don't want to have to pick up our net and move if we run into salmon. So we have structured our program into really avoiding bycatch areas. And we look at those areas that have salmon in them. We report it to the fleet. If the performance of that vessel is not adequate, then that vessel has to stay out of that area for a particular area. And I'm going to run down real quick how we've incorporated this. The first one here, Madam Chair, that doesn't show on your picture is really on my slide, a picture of VMS tracks. And it really is an alert system that we have. See if I hit it again. There it is. So this really is our communication. Communication is probably the most valuable tool that we have. We have on-the-grounds communication. Skippers are talking to skippers. As you know, and as I stated, we do not want to catch salmon. It is not something that we want to avoid at all costs, to avoid salmon. So in 2014, what's happened is we have an alert system now, thanks to technology, that if any of my fleet catches 10 or more salmon in a tow, an alert goes off to all of the industry. And when you're at sea, you can click on the website and you can see exactly where that vessel encountered the salmon. As you can imagine, the salmon and pollock like to get together. They feed on the same things. Often pollock feed on the Chinook salmon, or Chinook salmon feed on pollock, so they hang out together. And they're not always in the same places. So this alarm system really has heightened the awareness of encounters of salmon. We do identify bycatch avoidance areas. It's based on the number of salmon per pollock taken out of an area. If that number gets meets our threshold, then we start looking at the CP performance, our fleet performance. As you can see, those are the weeks of 2013. We had closures, and the numbers below are an indication of what vessels had to stay out of those areas. So you can see in February 28th, that week, we had 9 vessels that had to stay out of these areas. So it really provides an incentive to contain your behavior to avoid Chinook, and so you don't have to move out of these areas, because that's where the expense and the pain comes in. Additionally, Madam Chairman, real quickly, we have conservation areas. The top one is closed all the time during ace season. The bottom one is areas that historically we've seen Chinook salmon and what we call our B season. Those are conditional closures based on September performance. This is going to be in our final report. So this is what we caught last year. This is A and B season. This is just for my fleet, the CP fleet, and the CDQ. I probably should have mentioned that our IPA includes all the CDQ groups, so they sign on to this program. We caught, Madam Chairman, 573,726,000 metric tons of pollock. We caught 5,254 Chinook salmon while doing that, which gives you a bycatch ratio of 0.009. And I guess another way to look at that is about 100 metric tons of pollock we have generally run into one Chinook salmon. I should mention that I know that when you look at sounders and the equipment that they have on board, you can see schools of fish. Certainly you can see pollock. But you cannot see halibut or salmon that are contained in that. So the avoidance really comes after the fact. You get it on board. We have two observers. We have a whole bunch of cameras. We count the salmon. And before that skipper sets his net again, he gets a salmon count to determine whether he needs to move off that area or if he can put that net back in. So we're required to try to demonstrate to the council that the program that they instituted works. So this just shows you the 4 years before and the 4 years after the program, and I think it's pretty self-explanatory that for whatever reason, our bycatch performance has improved. Now, granted, I don't like to take credit for these results because I don't want to take the blame. It's a raw abundance. We all know that we have a Chinook crisis statewide. The Yukon-Kuskokwim is in disastrous state, and so we know that we're in times of low abundance. The incentive program is set up for us to avoid salmon no matter what the condition of pollock is or the condition of salmon. So our program is structured that way. We get a lot of information, Madam Chairman, because of our sampling. Now that we have two observers, we sample every 10th salmon comes on board. All of them are retained. And we now have genetics work. And as you can see, we are gathering the genetics work over time. And as you can see, coastal Western Alaska in 2013, the bycatch or the Western Alaska salmon in our bycatch decreased from previous years. So this is valuable information for the managers and for us as well. In 2015, we put three new provisions in, and I understand I'm running out of time, but we increased our communication. These were voluntary measures that we put into ours. We do require salmon excluder use all of A season and 2 months of the B season. And the last one, Madam Chairman, is probably the most interesting, and that is what we call an outlier provision. And as you can see, what we started looking at was, what has our behavior changed, and do we still have vessels that have outlier behavior? And as you can see, the top vessel does. From a standard deviation point of view, they were consistently outliers. And so we looked at defining what an outlier was, defining what a consistent outlier was, and developed a penalty structure to change that behavior. We do retain all of our salmon. We do contribute the salmon to Sea Share. I know that the CDQ groups and others help fund that program to bring the salmon back. We do also have a community catch share program, both at Beans Cafe and the Millionaire Club in Seattle, where we serve food to those clients, and we serve pollock. In summary, Madam Chairman, technology is helping. We continue to support research through the University of Alaska and APU. We believe that there's evidence that this program is working. And as you know, the council in April will be looking at reducing our limits in times of low abundance. Here's a list of our companies. Thank you for the opportunity today. And there's our website with more information.
Thank you very kindly for the presentation. And we're going to take a brief at ease while we set up for the next presenter, which will be Julie Barney from Groundfish Data Bank. Julie, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Okay, we're ready to go.
Okay, so obviously I'm not in the room. I'm here in Kodiak, and Reed's going to be my head assistant, so hopefully we can sync the PowerPoint presentation at the same time. So my name is Julie Bonney. I'm the executive director of Alaska Groundfish Data Bank, which is an organization that represents trawl vessels in the Gulf of Alaska and also shoreside processors. Next slide. Who is the Gulf trawl industry? I think it's important to understand that the Gulf is very different than the Bering Sea. There's really three components of our industry. There's the trawl catcher vessels, to deliver their catch predominantly to shoreside processors in Alaska coastal communities, predominantly to the communities of Kodiak, Sandpoint, and King Cove. Typically, the vessels are not owner-operated, but the majority of the vessel operators live in the communities that they deliver to. The Kodiak trawl fleet participates in the directed pollock, rockfish, cod, and flatfish fisheries in the central Gulf of Alaska, and the fleet typically delivers 60 to 70% of the total Kodiak port landings by volume, which really is a key in terms of why we have a year-round processing workforce that lives in our community. We also have the Sandpoint King Cove fleet that participate in the Western Gulf, and they are in the directed pollock and Pacific cod fisheries. And then finally, we also have a trawl catcher processor fleet that catch and process at sea. They fish flatfish and rockfish and catch incidental amounts of peacod and pollock. Next slide. The typical Kodiak processor vessel is usually about 80 feet. They fish pollock, cod, rockfish, and flatfish in the central Gulf, while the typical Sandpoint King Cove trawler is 58 feet or less, and they trawl for pollock and cod in the western Gulf. So these are much smaller vessels than what you see in the Bering Sea. In terms of kind of a reference point for management structures, Stephanie kind of walked through the AFA fishery in the Bering Sea, which is a catch share program. So virtually every trawl fishery on the Pacific coast, British Columbia, Pacific Northwest, and the Bering Sea Aleutian Islands operates under a catch share fishery management structure. These programs include allocation of target species and bycatch to either individual vessels or harvesting cooperatives. The AFA is a harvesting cooperative structure. The catch share programs create individual vessel accountability for each vessel's harvesting activity. Well, for the Gulf trawl fishery management structure, we're still operating under a limited access system, which is a race for fish similar to the state limited entry system. Next slide, please. The Gulf trawl limited access management system is really a race for fish where everywhere, both the processors and fishermen are competing for access to a common quota pool. This creates a number of problems. First, catch and bycatch is managed at the fleet level. There's no individual processor or vessel accountability. It's a competitive fishery where participants race for catch and process as much fish as fast as possible, which leads to overcapitalization for both vessels and processors. There's limited ability to address bycatch since there's no individual vessel accountability. There's a limited ability of process to vary product types to maximize product value. It creates stresses on community infrastructure since your water and electrical systems have to be built to meet peak demand from the processing sector, and it forces fishermen to go out and fish in unsafe fishing conditions. Understanding all this, with the salmon crisis, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council went ahead and implemented Chinook salmon bycatch limits for the Gulf trawl industry, even though they understood that we were still operating under this arcane management structure. The first incident was there was a high amount of Chinook salmon bycatch that occurred in the 2010 pollock fisheries in the Western Gulf, which prompted the council to take quick action and implement hard caps in the Gulf pollock fisheries. The Chinook salmon limit Gulf-wide is 25,000 fish, of which 18,000 and change is the cap for the Central Gulf fleet, and 6,700 approximately in the Western Gulf. Next slide. And this figure kind of demonstrates how the cap functions. So what the council looked at when they set the cap was the amount of bycatch compared to the pollock quota from 2001 to 2011. And so you can see, for instance, in the Central Gulf, the lime-colored line is the cap amount for Chinook. And then the two trend lines, one shows the pollock quota, which is in the blue color, and then the orange is the pollock catch. So in the Central Gulf, what's happened is the quota was about 40,000 tons of pollock during the historical time clip, but actually now in the Central Gulf, the actual quota is over 150,000 tons. So knowing that the Chinook cap isn't flexible, we're working to catch four times more pollock with the same amount of Chinook, which definitely has put some stress on the industry. In the Western Gulf, while you see that there has been, and you can see the big spike in 2010 that caused the need for the council to implement a cap, but as you can see, their quotas in that region has been trending upward, but their catches are not meeting the quota, and that's a combination of CPE and salmon bycatch. Next slide. So after the council implemented the Chinook caps in the pollock fisheries, and they went back and revisited the idea of whether there was too much Chinook being taken in non-pollock fisheries, which include cod, flatfish, and rockfish fisheries. Because we're so diverse with the CP element and the Western Central Gulf element, and then we also have one small catch-up program in rockfish, they set three different limits, which are, as you can see, are pretty small at 1,200 fish for the rockfish fishery, and 3,600 for the CP sector, and then the CV sector Gulf-wide at 2,700 fish. This has created a lot of challenges for the industry. The first issue is the bycatch accounting. So presently, the bycatch estimates for salmon are based from observer data, not fish tickets. So the observer bycatch rate is calculated from a basket sample, which means that they take a random sample of about 600 pounds from the catch at sea, and the salmon in that sample determines the rate that's extrapolated out to the haul and to the vessel. This is in comparison to the sampling in the pollock fishery, where in this case it's similar to the Bering Sea, where every salmon is censused at the plant by the observer to determine the amount of bycatch, where each salmon is counted at the dock. So for the non-pollock, there's a much less precise accounting, and there's a lot more variance around the estimate. And it's difficult because it's a fleet average, not an individual vessel performance. Next slide. Now, the other part of the challenge is, and we're already starting to realize that, is in 2015 was the first year that we're actually operating under these new caps. And what we're finding is with the Western Central CV cap, which is two different fleets, and delivering to two different sets of ports, that and we've only been operating it under for 2 months. What's happened is, as of March 14th, we've taken 1,056 Chinook, which is all being attributed to the Western Gulf cod fishery. That's 39% of our cap has already been used in 2 months, and we've still got 10 months to go. What's most likely going to happen is the Central Gulf Kodiak fleet is going to be shut down sometime later in the year, and we have no control over the outcome because the numbers are being driven by a different fleet. It's important to understand when they set the caps in the Gulf of Alaska, they had no idea about the stock of origin of their salmon at that time. And since 2012, the council and industry has been working hard to catch up with that and get more information. So what we've found is that so far 97% of the Chinook that we're catching is from the Pacific Coast, British Columbia, and Southeast. And then the other 3%. Most of it's coming out of the Northwest Gulf area. Next slide. So this is how they aggregate the different stocks to determine the stock of origin. So they group the different run returns. And so you can see on this that you've got the red at the lower right side, then you move up, which is the Pacific Northwest. Then British Columbia is the purple, and then yellow is southeast. And then all the other, so that's 97% of where our salmon's coming from. And then the other 3% is in the orange area, which is the Kodiak, Homer, Kenai area. And then we don't have any contributions from Western Alaska, Whistler Bay, the Yukon. Next slide. So this is the hatchery releases is available from the North Pacific, Anadromous Fish Commission, and you can see that for hatchery Chinook salmon, there's about 250 million Chinook hatchery releases a year. Canada at about 39 million in 2013, and over 200 million in the U.S. And of the U.S. component, 95% is from the Pacific Northwest and about 5% from Alaska. Next slide. So that's kind of the state of where we are with the scientific information and also the management regimes that have been put in place. Even though we're not managed under a more sophisticated management structure, the industry is still trying to be proactive. Obviously, in the fisheries, to catch the pollock that's available, we've had to do voluntary measures within our fisheries, which are similar in terms of we develop catch share programs and allocate pollock and bycatch to individual vessels. The problem with these kind of agreements is it's all voluntary, and only if one vessel chooses not to participate, then the whole thing detonates. We also do similar hotspots, not nearly as sophisticated as the Bering Sea, but we do try to communicate on the grounds to let folks know where there's salmon bycatch problems. Also, the entire fleet and all the Gulf processors have opted into the Sea Share program, and so the salmon that we are catching that's of food grade is being donated to food banks, and mostly in Alaska. We're catching up with the Bering Sea in terms of salmon excluder technologies. The excluders in the Bering Sea for the bigger vessels don't necessarily work on the smaller vessels in the Gulf of Alaska. So we're involved in several research initiatives to get better technologies for our fleet. And finally, we're actually funding a lot of the salmon bycatch stock of origin data collection. They needed an industry match for the sustainable salmon grant funding, so we participated in that, and then we're self-funding all the salmon work for the rockfish fishery. In terms of future initiatives in the council, they're talking about a comprehensive trawl bycatch tools package, which would be similar to a lot of the other programs across the Pacific coast. And that package was initiated in June of 2012. So it's a lot of information. If you guys have any questions or you want to call me directly, you certainly can. I'm sure Reed has my number. Thank you very much for the opportunity to make the presentation.
Thank you, Julie. And if it's possible for you to stay online until our presenters are finished, in case there's any questions for you.
Certainly, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next presenter will be Ryan. I'm going to have Ryan pronounce his last name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative Foster got it right. It's McKinster.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Ryan McKinster. I'm the Executive Director of the Southeast Alaska Guides Organization. Anyways, okay, here's kind of a little overview of the presentation, a little bit about us, talk about the statewide economic impacts of sport fishing generally, more specifically my area, Southeast Alaska. Just a quick update on last season and what we're looking for this season, and the importance of salmon to our industry, and also some concerns. I'm just going to keep that brief to one main concern in the interest of brevity. Acigo is the voice of Southeast Alaska charter fishing and lodge operations in Alaska and their supporters. Our mission is to promote the tradition of sport fishing in Southeast Alaska through reasonable regulations that ensure long-term sustainability of our business and fish resources. That's not limited to charter and lodge owners. Obviously, sport fishing in general for our residents that do not use non-guided trips is also important to us. They're kind of friends in our industry. Statewide, here's some economic contributions. I have to apologize. This research study was commissioned by Fish and Game in 2008. It's referencing the 2007 year. That's the latest data we have. The study actually was designed to be updated every year or two. It just has not been done recently. So these are the current numbers. We're looking to find out if there's a way to update these to make these numbers more current. There were 475,534 licensed anglers in 2007. They fished for a combined 2.5 million days. Approximately $1.4 billion was spent on that fishery, with 15,879 jobs, which accounted for about $545 million of income. And that, just for kind of a point of reference, that was 2.6% of income earned in the state and 3.6% of jobs. Now, a little more specifically about our area, Southeast Alaska, there was $274 million spent, $71 million of income, which accounted for 2,243 jobs. Non-resident spending in Southeast is unique compared to the rest of the state, where residents actually spend more and participate more in the fishery. In the Southeast, non-resident spending is actually more than residents. That accounted for 4.8% of income, 6.4% of our jobs in Southeast, and 80% of that fishing was in saltwater, which is a little different than the rest of the state. Just to give you an idea, here's kind of the migration pattern of salmon. So you see we actually share the resource with a couple other places, actually another country. Kind of my history, came from Washington, moved to Alaska, and didn't leave. I think that's kind of the same thing, how the salmon work. So just to give you an idea, just so you see that, there's a King Salmon Fishery Management Plan in place because we have to share this resource with our neighbors. And that actually, part of that plan is the Abundance Index, which occurs every year. We get that number. That number will come out for this year, probably pretty soon in the next couple weeks. And this dictates how many salmon we get as a whole for all of our industries, and then it's allocated underneath that by Fish and Game. And that kind of dictates what the regulations are for the sport fish industry. Just to give you an idea, here's the regulations for last year. I won't go through them, but you've probably seen them. I mean, I'm assuming some of you that live in the Southeast probably follow these pretty closely. And actually, having said that, all indicators, and 2.57 for abundance index is pretty high. It's actually possibly a record high for that number, which means we have fairly robust, actually minimal regulations that allow us to keep more fish throughout the season. And we actually expect to have the abundance index to be near that this year. All indicators are pointing to that. So having said that, okay, the importance of salmon charters are to the Southeast industry specifically is right now there are some changes, as you've probably heard over time, regarding the halibut fishery. That's one of the fisheries we also participate in. With tighter regulations on that, we've lost some charter bookings in our fleet. But luckily, our members have realized this. They realize changing market conditions, and so they've actively promoted salmon fishing to make up some of that lost revenue for themselves as well as the Southeast communities. So that's why, obviously, salmon is really important to us. A lot of people sometimes think of the Southeast charters as, not exclusively, but predominantly halibut, but salmon is a very important economic driver for our members and our communities. And any questions?
We will hold questions until our last presenter, but thank you. I appreciate your
presentation.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. I forgot I was not the last presenter anymore.
And our last presenter is Ricky Geese from Kenai River Sport Fishing Association.
Good Yes, hi. My name is Ricky Geese. I'm the executive director of Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. We're a 501c3 nonprofit stationed in Soldotna, focused on promoting the Kenai River as one of the great sport fishing rivers in the world. It's the largest sport fishing river in Alaska and the largest personal use fishery in Alaska. What I want to talk about today is give an update from the Pacific States Marine Fishery Commission. In 2012, Cook Inlet, along with the Kusakwin and the Yukon, was declared a salmon disaster area, and want to provide an emergency relief program that's being administered through the PSMFC. So initially, in 2014, NOAA Fisheries announced that there was $75 million that was appropriated by Congress as part of the fiscal budget, and it was allocated to six different fisheries across the country that were declared fishery disasters by the Department of Commerce. Alaska received $20.8 million for the Chinook salmon failures that occurred in 2012. And the funds were distributed in the following manner. There were direct payments made to commercial salmon fishers in Cook Inlet, the Yukon, and the Kusakwin Rivers. The recreational sector in Cook Inlet received sport fishing guides, sport fishing guide businesses, sport fishing related businesses, and seafood manufacturers for sport fishing. Those areas in Cook Inlet were broken down to the Cook Inlet, Kenai Peninsula freshwater areas, the Cook Inlet saltwater areas, and the northern inlet freshwater areas comprised of the Natsu Borough. Remaining monies after direct payments will be centered on research, restoration, education, gear replacement, modifications, and outreach, and I'll talk a little bit about that at the end. There were also payments going to salmon buying stations and processors in Upper Cook Inlet related to the commercial salmon fisheries. The harvester component has been paid out. That was paid out last summer. This past winter, we worked with the Natsu Borough and the Kenai Peninsula Borough, along with user groups, to develop the applications for the sport fishing guides and the guide businesses and the related businesses. So who is eligible for the sport fishing guide industry? There were 80 FNG guide license in 2012, and you had to be a guide in the years prior, 2007, and a year from 2007 to 2011. You need to have participated in the logbook program as a guide from 2007 to 2011 in Cook Inlet Peninsula freshwater systems, Cook Inlet saltwater, or the northern inlet freshwater systems. The Department of Fish and Game shared that information through the logbook program with the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission, and that's the data that's used to qualify sport fishing guides and sport fishing guide businesses. Fish and Game occupational licenses in 2012 for sport fishing guide businesses, and in any one year between 2007 and 2011, and you need to have provided guide logbook information in any of those three areas once again. For the seafood manufacturing, they needed to have a license in 2012 for seafood manufacturing, and we use the NAICS codes, business codes, and those were fresh frozen seafood processing or seafood canning. They had to have a business license in any one year prior, the 5 years prior. The physical address must be located in either the Kenai Peninsula Borough or the Natsu Borough. We excluded Seward because it wasn't really related to the Cook Inlet fisheries, and we excluded the Denali area from the Natsu Borough. There was a percentage qualification for businesses and the amounts of loss. Those were qualifiers that I will talk about in the next slide. The fourth category was sport fishing related businesses, and again, you needed to have a business license in 2012 for sport fishing related businesses. And these were including but not limited to accommodations, air transportation, charters for fly out fishing, boat landings, retail businesses for sport fishing, food services, and fish taxidermy. And you had to have a business license in any of the 1 years from 2007 to 2011. Again, the physical address must have been located in the Kenai Peninsula Borough or the Natsu Borough. Here's where the qualifications for the business applications were. 35% of your business had to be related to cooking at Finfish. And in the 3 months, in the May, June, and July of any of the qualifying years, which was 2007 to 2011, you had to have a gross of $10,000. You must have been able to document at least a 35% loss, business loss in 2012 when compared to any one of the qualifying years in 2007 to 2011. On the commercial side for segments, those were the same qualifications, basically. We had 5 years of qualifying, the 5 previous years to 2012, and you had to document at least 35% business loss. On the commercial SetNet side, it was based on the poundage that was recorded being delivered to processors. Currently, the application period is ongoing right now. There have been about 2,900 applications sent out to qualifying businesses through the business codes in the Kenai Peninsula and the Matsu Borough. Approximately half of that is either the sport fishing guides and the sport fishing guide businesses, and the remaining half are the sport fishing related businesses. The deadline for this part of the program is going to be May 29th, and the funds most likely should be released to qualifying businesses by July 1. The remaining funds primarily are going to go towards research. We have plans in place. We should, along with the seafood processors and the buying stations, that should be done by the end of summer. So this coming fall, we are going to focus on two research areas. One is we're going to try and develop a research plan for bottlenecks of king salmon mortality in the marine environments. And the other one is going to be trying to find out, are there marine indices that could be utilized by fish and game management, and those specifically would be towards run timing for king salmon and king salmon abundance. In 2012, what we found was that the run timing was a couple weeks late, and so in the normal patterns of fish and game, we had closures because we didn't think the run was coming, and we don't really have indices in the marine environments. However, there's innovative research that's happening through NOAA and with the state on the Yukon, trying to figure out if we can get marine indicators, water temperatures, other indices to figure out if we have a better handle on run timing. So those are the things that we're going to try and develop for the Gulf of Alaska, try and develop a research plan, and then go out and seek funding, additional funds to support that research plan.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from this committee for any of our presenters before we go to public testimony? Yes, Representative Ortiz.
So, Madam Chair, are we just supposed to kind of direct it to the specific?
Yes, okay. Please. And if the question is directed to you and you're sitting in the audience, if you would come up to the table and identify yourself, we'd appreciate it.
Directed, I guess, more specifically to Ms. Hardcastle. I appreciated your presentation this morning, and you know, you testified that that we, quote, we, the United States, doesn't yet have a seat at the table in relationship to our concerns around transboundary mining issues. And yet we have, according to your testimony, the support of our federal delegation, and we have, I assume, we have this, the support of the State Department as well. They're doing what they can. So my question, I guess, is what is preventing that seat at the table?
All right, yeah, thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Heather Hardcastle again, and thank you, Representative Ortiz, for that question. I think I indicated in my presentation that none of this is easy. And when I mentioned that the International Joint Commission is the mechanism that exists before us to bring that table to front and center and allow us an equal seat at that table with Canada. That's very true. It really is the only existing policy mechanism. The roadblocks right now before us to getting an IJC investigation are a bit numerous. We do have a congressional delegation on our side, as you mentioned. We have a whole lot of residents in Southeast Alaska and interest groups, including local governments. We don't, however, yet have the formal support of the state of Alaska. I know the state of Alaska is discussing this, and Lieutenant Governor Malott chairs a transboundary working group that's at the commissioner level, so I know they're certainly taking this seriously. But currently, to my knowledge, they haven't formally stated that they support an International Joint Commission investigation. And then secondly, the State Department isn't outright in support of this necessarily. They are the diplomats for the United States. They have the tough conversations with our neighbors like Canada, and they need to know, it seems, they need to know that all of us, including the state of Alaska, including state legislators, including majority of residents, really want them to go to bat for us and ask the tough questions of Canada. Thirdly, pragmatically, we need the support of Canada to have the International Joint Commission activated to study this issue. And they're not necessarily excited to do that, I would say. That said, we work closely with a number of folks who are experts on the IJC and used to work for the IJC. And one thing they always state for us is that both countries are hyper aware that there's going to be a situation where they want the International Joint Commission to be involved. And it's not a case of just being able to say no. Does that answer the question? We're in that stage right now where we're still trying to raise a stink that we want some sort of forum to address this issue.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
That.
Follow Thank up. You.
Follow up.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hardcastle, so it's not active now? You said it needs to be reactivated.
Right, yeah. So through the chair to Representative Herron, the International Joint Commission, when it, quote-unquote, becomes activated and looks at an issue like the cumulative effects of multiple mining projects on the transboundary watersheds, it requires the joint referral of the issue by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Canada and by the State Department in the United States. In order for the State Department and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to take an issue like this and refer it to the International Joint Commission, they need to hear from residents. They need to hear from the state of Alaska, as I mentioned, and from state legislators and elected officials, as well as fishermen and tribes. Senator Murkowski is someone, along with Senator Sullivan, that's really tracking this closely. And when we met with her a month ago, she met with Secretary of State John Kerry the next day about this issue. And we have to continue that kind of pressure. And that's where all of you, frankly, come in, is stating that this is not anti-mining. It's not anti the permitting process that exists in Canada. It's simply, let's get to the table and talk about a shared resource with another country.
Time out.
Follow up, Representative Herron.
So have you specifically requested the Alaska legislature for a resolution, for example?
We did not formally request that, although over the years we've been in close touch with the Southeast legislative delegation in particular, because those of us from Juneau have been concerned about the Tulsa Chief Mine on the Taku for a long time. But Representative Ortiz did take the leadership role in putting together a resolution, HGR 16, I believe. And I believe that's going to be scheduled for a hearing hopefully soon. So that is before the House of Representatives, or will be. And that specifically, again, if I'm not mistaken, Representative Ortiz, supports the involvement of the International Joint Commission, recognizing that's really the only forum we have right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Hearing no other questions, I will open up public testimony. And online we have Ben Stevens from the Tanana Chiefs Conference. Ben, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me clearly?
We certainly can. Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much. My name is Ben Stevens, B-E-N-S-T-E-V-E-N-S. I am a tribal member from Stevens Village, which is north of Fairbanks on the Yukon River. As you mentioned, I do work with the Tanana Chiefs, but first I want to mention that I am a subsistence fisherman. I have spent pretty much the entirety of my life growing on the river during the summertime in fish camp, and so I've got a considerable amount of experience being what we're referring to as a subsistence fisherman. My experience in camp includes feeding roughly 5 to 7 families for the entire year. And so not only our family, but a whole handful of other folks helped participate in this activity, and they were set for the year. So I'd like to talk just a little bit about economies that were often referred to here, but in a slightly different respect. But first, officially, like I mentioned, I do work with the Tanana Chiefs Conference. I'm helping them coordinate the Hunting and Fishing Task Force strategy that talks about hunting and fishing rights of the folks that we serve. Folks, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to add to your discussion here. I do appreciate your effort, because a lot of times the subsistence discussion is not included in any discussion or consideration. So I do appreciate that, and I want you to know that I do see that, and a lot of the folks that I work with do see that also. I've been asked to speak on the subsistence in relation to the state of the salmon this morning, and I want to bring to light not only the industry and the cash economies I referred to earlier and that you've heard much of, but also the economy that we don't always consider, and that is of the rural lifestyle. And that is basically going from, you know, the fish going straight from the water to the plate. Not big industry or any of that, but just mom and dad on the shore trying to feed the kids. That is our economy. So anyway, this is an incredibly critical time being faced by our folks out there in rural Alaska, the Alaska residents that are outside the cities. It's across the entire state. This is a very dire time for the subsistence users. As we all know, the subsistence not only involves the economies that you are hearing about all today, but the basic sustenance that connects so solidly to our physical, our spiritual, cultural health and well-being. So the folks out there in rural Alaska, not being able to fish for food is definitely unnerving and a lot of times off your radar. And so, again, I really do appreciate the opportunity to shed some light here. As we all know, the salmon declines have been present with us since roughly 98-ish. 2000 being a real hard year. Last year, of course, folks along the entirety of the Yukon endured the total moratorium of Chinook fishing. Subsistence users have been hoping and pleading and demanding the address of this situation for years, but are now, as of the last couple of years, being faced with the stark reality of the disappearance of some of our stocks. And considering the fact that the folks out in rural Alaska bear the burden of these declines and see the lack of action on both the state and the federal management regimes, tribes have started taking action themselves. And I wanted to share a couple of things that the tribes have done that I think that folks should keep on the radar, because it could help with salmon restoration and conservation efforts that you folks are dealing with right now. First of all, I want to mention the last summer's full moratorium on fishing. Given that many fish to the spawning grounds would not have been possible had it not been for the involvement, that unified voice from tribes. I think that was a tremendous, tremendous sign from tribes that they are all in on the restoration and conservation of the stocks. Another dire effort, or another very drastic effort on the part of tribes, was to seek the federal involvement in fisheries to grab the advantage of rural preference. That was a hard one, because the tribes out there are looking for some help, and they're not getting it. So this type of a dire situation calls for drastic action. One thing I want to throw out there is the fact that the Kuskokwim River's watershed and the Yukon River watershed, folks are all in the planning for fish commissions. That in itself, I think, says a tremendous amount that as stocks disappear and nothing is done about it, they are going to do what they can to make some substantive effort in this regard. Basically, the tribes are looking to the state and the feds for more of a substantive voice in the management actions. And I do think that now is the time that we should give that some real, real serious consideration. Just a couple more points that I want to throw out, and that is that we're calling for all who have the ability to affect the salmon restoration and conservation to take action. And right now we're in the process of working with the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council to lower the bycatch. We understand that that's only one of the possible reasons that can impact fish getting to the spawning grounds, or us being able to eat fish for dinner. We realize that that's only one of the factors that could be at play, but it's one that I think that we can have an impact by addressing. When our kids can't eat one fish, then any one fish of bycatch is unacceptable, and anyone to suggest otherwise is offensive. And so we're hoping that the council will step up and do the right thing in terms of bycatch. Another thing I've heard other folks talk about.
I'm going to have to ask you to sum it up here shortly. We have other people that want to testify, and we have a time limit. But
the ability to work with other governments. The tribes of the Yukon River have been working with the First Nations in Canada and the government of the Yukon, and it is going very well. So I would say that that is a good example of the bridges that we are building. So with that, I will thank you for your time, and I will cut short. Again, I do appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. We have a question for you, Representative Ortiz.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. When you speak about the dire situation and the critical time that we're in for your folks, for your people, in particular for subsistence fishing, are we or even only speaking about the situation with the king salmon, or is there, and is that really the only fish that you target for subsistence, or are we talking about other species of salmon as well?
Well, we do target the king because of the quality of the nutrients and other reasons. However, we are very concerned about how the disappearance of the Chinook is going to impact the other salmon stocks out there in the Yukon. As we know, everything is in a perilous state at the moment. We saw the Fall Chum crash a few years ago, and we know that that nothing is for granted here. So we're concerned about all of them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ortiz. Okay, our next individual is George Pierce from Kasilaf. And Mr. Pierce, I'm going to ask you if you could keep your comments to 5 minutes. We have several people that would like to testify. Are you there?
Yes, ma'am, I am. Can you hear me?
Okay, if you'd state your name for the record, please.
My name is George Pierce, and I'm calling from Kasilaf, Alaska, and I'm representing subsistence users. Thank you for taking my testimony, and I'll try to hurry as quick as I can. I'd like for you folks sitting there at the commission there listening to our testimony. I got a little homework for you to do if you would. The subsistence users, we are being trumped by non-residents over fishing rights. We've got guides that are literally destroying the Kenai River, taking all the canes out of the river by fishing continually over 20 years over the spawning beds. But the problem is subsistence. If you look in the state of Alaska, subsistence users are entitled to the fishing game first. Okay, by saying that, we have now come up to a person's use fishery that eliminates the subsistence users first and puts them where they're the first ones to be yanked out of the water in case of a shortage. It states in the Constitution the residents, the subsistence users, are entitled to this fishery and the game first. So back in 1993 to 1995, there was a dispute over rural and non-rural. And the fish board came up with personal use and did away with the subsistence name of subsistence. And that's what we are. We wouldn't change our personal use status. They did. We're still subsistence users of this state, and we're entitled to this fish first. Okay, by saying that, in 1995, the fish board said that we're going to create this personal use fishery. And by the way, we were never allowed to fish in the mouth of the river, and we had 3 months as a subsistence user to get our fish. So they created this fishery, and it was challenged, and it went to court. The state court said it's against the law to determine people that live in rural or non-rural as subsistence. All people that live in the state of Alaska is entitled to subsistence. So the fishing game lost, but they still proceeded to go with it, and our legislators passed it to where they could implement personal use. I'd like for you to investigate this. It's in the fishing game. That's where you find it. So they created an illegal fishery called the personal use, and now if there's a shortage, like I said, we're yanked out of there first, and the commercial fishermen and the sport fishing guides get to continually fish. And I like to point out that the sport fishing guides, they cater to non-residents. That's what they target, non-residents. So we're being trumped by non-resident fishermen, and the sport fishing guys are taking our kings and selling to their clients. This is against the Constitution of the state. We're entitled to these fish first, and I would like for our legislators to stand up and do something about this. It's a problem, and it's against the law to have that fishery. The subsistence fishery used to last all month, or for 3 months during the summer. There was never a problem of crowding in our rivers because we were never allowed in the rivers. And now the personal use fishery, you can fish in them rivers for literally month after month. It's too crowded, it's ruining the habitat, it's ruining the quality of our river, and nobody is stepping up to it because of the money. It's our resources, the Alaskans. We should be entitled to this, and I hope this committee checks into this illegal fishery called a personal use fishery and step up for the Alaskans. We're the ones that vote you in. We're the ones that expect you to do what we're asking, not cater to the guide service over money. It's our fishery and it's our resources. We should be first and everybody else is thereafter. So I would like for you to investigate how this rural and non-rural area came about. The legislators gave the fish and game permission to implement the personal use fishery, which is against the Constitution. So I hope that the legislators and this committee here changes it back to where I can have my subsistence rights back and I can fish all summer long without headaches of somebody drowning or getting hit by a boat because we're jammed into literally 2 miles of a river.
Thank you, Mr. Pierce. We're going to have to sum it up here. We're on a time limit.
Okay, thank you for taking my testimony, and I hope you do investigate this non-resident or non-rural and rural issue because we're all entitled to our fishing game.
Well, we certainly appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Thanks.
We have Dan Dunaway in Dillingham. Mr. Dunaway, are you available?
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please state your name for the record, and if you could limit your comments to 5 minutes, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.
I'll do my best. Yes, I'm Dan Dunaway. I live here in Dillingham, lifetime resident of Alaska. I do sit as a secretary of the Nishigak Fish and Game Advisory Committee, and I'm also a member of the Federal Bristol Bay Rural Advisory Council for Subsistence. Today, however, my comments are my own personally. I just want to make that clear. I'm a subsistence user. My family's subsistence user. I'm also a sport angler. And my son was a first-time commercial fisherman last year. Just a few items, and some of these our advisory committee is in the process or has sent letters of concern about funding for some of the fish and game management tools that are used in the Nishigak and Togiak area, and I have a personal interest there too. I would like to see the Nishigak sonar salmon enumeration project funded sufficiently to run through August the pink and coho fisheries. This would help sort out there's a management plans that kind of sort out the allocation among commercial, sport, and subsistence users, and that sonar sites essential to make that plan work. Also, funding we hear rumors that the Togiak salmon counting tower it could be on the chopping block in these severe budget cuts, and we understand the severity of the situation, but the Togiak counting tower is the sole management tool Fish and Game has for their run of 700,000 to over 800,000 sockeye salmon. Normally produces about 550,000 fish harvest in the commercial fishery, as well as subsistence. Another concern that has kind of popped up among some of the advisory committees is that with the short funding, we kind of get caught in a problem where we have to have a minimum of one meeting a year to be considered an active advisory committee, but if funds are cut much more, it'll be hard to maintain our active status. And it also makes it difficult for us to get to our essential face-to-face meetings, which are just critical. Teleconferences, you know, have limited utility. And I just want to remind you, these advisory committees and that whole board support process is, I see it as an underpinning of the original formation of the state of Alaska through citizen participation in a fish and game management. One last thing I wanted to bring up is I see that bycatch was a big topic, and I wanted, as RAC member for Bristol Bay, we were pleased to have the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council come out and present their work on controlling and managing bycatch. It is a big concern, and the Bristol Bay RAC has been shown unity with the Western other RACs at Kuskokwim and Yukon, calling for severe restrictions to bycatch. But we also are glad to see the innovations and how hard work that those trawl fisheries are doing to improve their efforts. I was just at a local meeting here in Dillingham of interagency group where Dr. Dan Schindler presented a new study on using strontium isotopes to determine origin of small salmon. And I wondered, I never got the chance to ask him, but genetics have been really limited in identifying Western Alaska chum or Western Alaska king salmon. It's very vague, and I'm wondering if the strontium technique might be developed to help better identify stocks of origin in this bycatch. And Schindler is a professor at the University of Washington and highly regarded. And those are just kind of my shotgun items I wanted to pass on to you. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate it. We have John McCombs from the Kenai LIO. Mr. McCombs?
Hello.
We certainly can. Please state your name for the record, and if you could limit your comments to 5 minutes, we'd appreciate it.
Well, dear, my name is John McCombs. I live in the Neltje for the last 39 years. Regarding HB 110 and SB 42, currently there are 80 personal use fisheries statewide. Ramifications of these bills are neither explained or rationalized. It is very premature and misguided to initiate a dialogue about who gets to catch the last fish. Therefore, I cannot support SB 42 or HB 110. On HB 103, in 2014, the Board of Fish passed two board-generated proposals that last 2 hours of a two-week-long meeting. Both proposals contained contentious reallocations of the fishery. Board-generated proposals take the public out of an open public process. They undermine the advisory committee process. Why even have proposals submitted if the Board of Fish creates their own political proposals in the 11th hour of a two-week-long meeting?
Mr. McCombs, can I interrupt you for just a moment? I'm not sure if you're aware that the presentation today was on the state of the salmon, and if you have testimony on a salmon issue, we'd like to kind of confine our testimony today to that issue.
Sure. Well, I'm going to support House Bill 103, and I hope you do too. And thanks for this opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any other, no other people online? Any other buddies here in the audience that would like to testify or have a comment? If not, I will close public testimony. And with that, we'll be meeting again on Thursday, and on Thursday we will be hearing House Bill 112 to repeal the CFEC and transfer the functions to the Department of Fish and Game, and we will have public testimony on that day. It'll be 10 o'clock, the 26th, in this room. And if there's no further business to come before this committee, I will adjourn the House Fisheries Committee meeting at 11:52.